Now, the middle of May 1978, the daffodils were up, but spring hadn't yet arrived in Connecticut. Lorraine had planned to spend Saturday the 13th planting flowers in her backyard garden. But gale force winds blew across the state, followed the 5 days of heavy rain. I'm reading from The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren, by Gerald Brittle. Too cold in here. Turn the lights down. Make it scary. The weather was a fitting end to a week in which nothing had gone right. In fact, tensions had been building for Lorraine since the beginning of the month. She knew something would soon have to give. With torrential rain beating on the house, the Warrens spent that wet Saturday afternoon planning the itinerary for their upcoming trip to England. Because their work often takes them to the United Kingdom, they've developed an additional expertise in British haunting sites and were therefore booked to lecture on board the Queen Elizabeth II in June. Upon arriving in England, they would spend 2 days in London honoring interview commitments with the BBC, then travel to Yorkshire, Edinburgh, the Scottish Highlands near Loch Ness, and Stonehenge, before returning to Southampton in July to lecture on the return passage. Having made a dent in their UK plans that afternoon, the Warrens went out to dinner in the evening. Arriving home just after midnight, Lorraine reviewed the calls left on the answering machine. There was a message from a friend in Los Angeles. Then a call from her daughter Judy on vacation in Virginia. After that, a young man's request for an appointment with Ed. Then a bizarre series of clicks and odd whirring sounds, followed by the distraught voice of an unfamiliar woman. Quote, "I hope you can hear me. My name is Hillman, Mrs. Jean Hillman. I don't exactly know what has happened here," she said in a barely controlled voice, "but my children have been hit and chased for something. Hesitation. And there is somebody or something in the house, upstairs, in one of the children's bedrooms. Please call me back just as soon as you possibly can." Both Ed and Lorraine listened silently as the distressed woman gave her address and telephone number. Although it was 12:40 a.m., Lorraine immediately tried to return the woman's call. "When a case is referred to us," Ed explains, "now these are very famous Catholic demonologists, laymen, but probably one of a dozen more experienced in dealing with the supernatural, the evil portion, than anybody else in America. They were called in by West Point." Most of my people know this, but there are people watching for the first time. "By West Point to deal with a supposed or alleged ghost by the superintendent at West Point, no less, in the 70s. They were the experts called in on the Amityville horror case. Here they go again." I was going to say more, but I decided I'm tired of reviewing. "When a case is referred to us," Ed explains, "we immediately contact the individual or family in trouble. If it seems necessary for us to enter the case, then we'll offer to help. We tell the family that we don't charge for our time, but we must be reimbursed for basic expenses, such as airfare, hotel rooms, and so on. When that's understood, we set up an appointment as soon as possible. Usually, we're on our way within an hour or two. Mrs. Hillman's phone rang continuously, then the connection was broken. Lorraine hung up and dialed again. This time, it sounded as though someone had picked up the receiver, but the phone still kept ringing. The third time she tried the telephone number, Lorraine got the same frustrating response. At a loss, Lorraine dialed the operator, who then dialed the number and met with the very same problem. In turn, the operator summoned her supervisor, who listened to Lorraine's explanation that she was trying to return a distress call. Understanding and helpful, the supervisor ran the call through a number of electronic test procedures, but to no avail. She admitted being puzzled. There's nothing wrong with the telephone on the receiving end. Your call should make a connection. Nonetheless, the Warrens were unable to get through that night. As Ed and Lorraine knew very well, what happened with the Hillman's phone was not unusual. In fact, such electronic tricks are commonplace when a malevolent spirit is at work. Interference, obstruction, confusion, tactics which cause delay, or routine for a determined spirit with the ability to manipulate both physical and metaphysical variables. The next morning, Sunday the 14th, the Warrens drove to church. On the way, now, here I go again. I'm in it. There are bound to be people listening for the first time, and they're going to think I'm crazy. I don't believe a word of any of this. But it's true. I mean, I think it's all a crock. These things just don't happen. This is out of the Middle Ages. It did. I've read it over and over. I must be in the eighth reading now. I ain't even going to read The Devil in Connecticut. You just read it. Just read it yourself. On the way, a powerful, rank smell of excrement filled their car. Somebody hiding under the seat. Then midway through the church service, the same foul, psychically projected odor assaulted the Warren senses. Once again, as they were returning home in the car, they were nauseated by a disgusting stench. I can't read this stuff. All my credibility and 10 years is going to be destroyed. Then I'm going to finish. Ed and Lorraine, however, did not associate it with the demonic case they were about to investigate that afternoon. Well, that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense. At least they're not asking me to believe the unbelievable now. They sure trusted each other. That's all I got to say. When the Warrens returned from church, I want to tell you, if you got a demon assaulting you like that, stay home. Don't you come to the King's House on Sunday morning. You just call me up. I'll come out and exercise the place for you. I mean, knocking on wood and all that other stuff, that was scary. This is just plain awful. When the Warrens returned from church, I'm going to keep going. Lorraine immediately telephoned the Hillman family. Mrs. Hillman answered the phone on the second ring. Lorraine told her the difficulty that she had reaching them the night before. The phone was in working order, the woman replied, but it didn't ring after midnight. I know, because I was waiting for you to call. The problem with the telephone upset the women even further, so Lorraine made an appointment to visit the family that afternoon. By 2 p.m., the Warrens had arrived at an address just outside the University of Massachusetts. The Hillman home was a typical Cape Cod house on a wooded plot, where Ed and Lorraine later discovered the family had lived for the past 13 years. Isn't it amazing how much of this is New England? All members of the family were present that afternoon. Al Hillman, a plumber, was a youthful-looking 35. His wife, Jean, with whom Lorraine had spoken on the phone, was her husband's age, but she looked drawn and upset. They had not witnessed the phenomena, however. It had been experienced by their three children, Dee, 15, Bob, 14, and Melena, 11, or Melanie. Ed arranged his recording gear on a nearby table while Lorraine asked their permission to walk the house. Now, I've read enough of this to you. You know Lorraine is clairvoyant. When the Warrens are working together, oh, I know, there are people that say, I don't believe in that stuff. Well, I don't either. I mean, you know, don't take it out on me. I don't believe this smell. I just am stunned by the credibility of the reporters. You know, if some people tell you something, you're going to take another look at it, even though you know they're lying. This couldn't be true. And so far, this one's pretty tame. Kind of awful, but tame. I mean, rocks falling on the house, and spooks flying around. This one's just got a bad smell thus far, and a telephone that doesn't work. Most of us have experienced both of those at some time or other. Just we're not so stupid we write a book about it. You know, it'd be nifty if you could blame the devil for everything, wouldn't it? Ed arranged his recording gear. How do you record smells? Ed arranged his recording gear on a nearby table while Lorraine asked their permission to walk the house. When the Warrens are working together, Lorraine will usually investigate the premises clairvoyantly while Ed interviews the family. She'll begin in the basement and work her way up to the topmost floors, stopping in each room of the house. Because clairvoyance is a sensibility like the other five, that I do believe. It is not possible for her to deny psychic input any more than she can refuse to see or hear. That I believe. I want to tell you, I believe Adam and Eve were both clairvoyant. And I think what we call parapsychology can be supernaturally induced and added to, both by evil spirits and good spirits. But I also think it can be a natural trait hidden recessively in the genes until the statistical probability of them connecting in the chromosomes is so rare that they're about as rare as the true clairvoyant. But what we see is an outcrop of senses and abilities that were very natural to Adam and Eve. That I find no difficulty in believing at all. Therefore, if there's a spirit presence in a home, chances are excellent that Lorraine will become aware of it. As she left the room, Ed began an extensive interview. Both Mr. and Mrs. Hillman made it clear that they had not experienced any of the phenomena their children talked about. But I would imagine, Mrs. Hillman said, that this is probably my fault, at least from what little I know about the subject. D has always been interested in the occult, witchcraft, spells, that sort of thing. She has a small library, but none of the books were on conjuring. So last Christmas, I bought her one on conjuring demons as a present. Merry Christmas to you, a Merry Christmas to you. Pull up some little demons. Merry Christmas to you. I mean, that's quite a gift. You give them the conjuring book, and they can just pull things up all year long. I honestly didn't think anything like this was going to happen. Okay, Ed said, turning to Dee, where's this book? Upstairs, the girl answered, it's a paperback. It explains how to conjure something like 75 different demons. It tells the correct ritual and explains the debt you pay if the ritual works. Did you perform any of the rituals? Yes. What demons did you try to conjure? Which ones? She repeated. I don't know. I only did a few of the easy rituals. The ones I could understand and had the equipment for. When I did them, though, nothing happened, so I didn't bother anymore. Sometimes the response will come days, weeks, months, even years later, Ed informed her. Tell me about what happened to you this week. You had trouble, I believe. Twice, said Dee. Who was here when it happened? Bob, Melanie, and me, she answered. The first time was this past Thursday. Dad and Mom went out to their friend's house. We stayed home because we had school the next day. Melanie and Bob were already in bed. I'd just taken a shower. I went downstairs to make sure the doors were locked. I also turned off the radio and downstairs lights before I went back upstairs. When I got to my bedroom, I heard the water running in the bathroom. I didn't think about it at first, but a few minutes later I went down the hall and saw all the faucets were turned on. I turned them off. Then I heard the radio on again downstairs. The lights were on too. I yelled, "Who's there?" But nobody answered me. Before I went downstairs again, I looked into Melanie's room. She was asleep in her bed. I looked into Bob's room too, but he wasn't asleep yet. I asked if he turned the radio on downstairs. He said he hadn't. So I then went down and turned off the lights and radio a second time. When I came back upstairs, the water in the bathroom was running again. This got me mad because I was sure Bob was doing it. But when I came out of the bathroom, the radio was on real loud and all the lights were on downstairs. I went into Bob's room and says, "There's someone in the house." "Bob, did you hear the radio?" asked Ed. "Yeah, I heard it, but I didn't think anything about it," he answered. "Did you turn on the water?" Ed asked quickly, hoping to catch him off guard. "No way," the boy replied. "I never even got out of bed." "Okay, D," Ed said. "Please go on." D. From upstairs, I could hear the radio changing stations. So I went right back down again, thinking my parents might be home. When I got down there this time, the radio dial was moving back and forth all by itself. I stood there and watched it. And that's when I stood there and watched it. And that's when I got down there this time, the radio dial was moving back and forth all by itself. I stood there and watched it. And that's when I started to get scared. I turned off the radio and the lights again. But when I got halfway up the stairs, I felt an icy, cold hand touch me on the shoulder. Just for a second in the dark. I almost screamed, but I didn't. I just went right to my bedroom, shut the door, and turned off the light. Now, why in the hell's tarnation did she do that? Before I got to my bed, though, I heard the sound of footsteps, like someone was walking out of my room into the hall. But the door never opened. Well, didn't you think any of this was strange? You had one to know. Sure I did, said D. I was scared out of my mind. Melanie, did you hear the radio head ask her? Uh-uh, I was asleep, answered the little girl. Now, D, did anything else happen after you heard the footsteps leave the room? Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Now, what in hell's tarnation did you do that for? When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly, yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and close my eyes. Suddenly. And you know what happened all of a sudden? I do. You will if you call me. Now, I got to find out. I'm on all these new people now. You want me to continue on demonology? Now, Jesus ran into them everywhere he went. He found them in the synagogue. He found them enjoying the breezes around the Sea of Galilee. I'm on the subject of demonology. Long overdue that we take an intelligent look at it. I started with a Catholic demonologist. Now I'm back to him. The devil in Connecticut. Scariest story I ever heard. The only place I know of where national news picked it up, Arne Johnson's defense in his murder trial was it was done by a demon when the person was 20 feet from him. The devil in Connecticut. You want me to finish this story?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Suddenly, you didn't think I would. You shouldn't think evil of your pastor. Get you in trouble. Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly, I heard a door downstairs slam real hard. Suddenly, I heard a door downstairs slam real hard. After that, I heard furniture being pushed around and crashing, like it was being thrown with somebody who was very mad. I really thought there was someone in the house, but I was too scared to do anything, so I just kept my eyes closed. But even though my eyes were closed, I could see my whole room through my eyelids. I don't believe any of this. I opened my eyes, but nothing was different, so I closed my eyes again. Then through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand, now if you want me to keep going, you better call. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. You want me to finish?
Yes, sir.
Anybody calling?
Yes, sir.
Now, Dee, did anything else happen after you heard the footsteps leave the room? Turn the lights down. Yeah. Plenty. When I got to bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly, I heard a door slam downstairs real hard. After that, I heard furniture being pushed around and crashing like it's being thrown by somebody who was very mad. I really thought there was someone in the house, but I was too scared to do anything, so I just kept my eyes closed. But I've seen buts lead to some terrible things, but this is the worst. It's the worst I've ever seen. But I have to turn you off on butts forever. I don't think I'll read another line. I mean, that's one connecting word should be left out of the English language. It always leads to something terrible. What is that? But even though, you watch, you'll agree with me. Even though my eyes were closed, I could see my whole room through my eyelids. I don't believe this. It's true. It's what makes me mad. I opened my eyes, but nothing was different, so I closed my eyes again. Then, through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand, that's where I was. Right there. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. Now, that's a hand. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. That's what I said, wasn't it? I don't think I should go on. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. Now, remember in that book, let me see, where is it now? It's here somewhere. Pentecostals were laughed at over things like this. Now, this is a Catholic I'm reading about. And poor old Lester Sumrall. Bless his heart, I like Lester. But he had a hard time making people believe this story for a while. The true story of Clarita Villanueva. Remember, we left this story, didn't we? Huh? He tells the story in Manila. It was the tape recorder in the hands of the news reporter mentioned by Dr. Lara that forced me into the story. Oh, you want me to go back to that? I know. I mean, you know, I want you to know your vibrations are getting through. The broadcast of the Clarita interview over station DZFM lasted for 45 minutes. It was one of the most blood-curdling programs I've ever heard. In fact, the only program to approximate it was the drama by Orson Welles called Invasion from Mars. The radio announcer dramatically announced the broadcast as follows. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a weak heart, please turn your radio off. So everybody called whomever had a weak heart and said, turn it on. I turned the dial of our radio up higher, and instantly there were piercing screams followed by pandemonium. Doctors spoke out of the confusion. This can all be explained. Our records show that this phenomenon has been known before. This is fugue. This is epilepsy. It is extreme hysteria. Other persons were excitedly saying, look, the marks of teeth appear. Another would say the girl is being choked by some unseen thing. She's blue in the face and there are marks on her neck. Then Clarita would scream again. I turned to my wife and said, this girl is not sick and the doctors are helpless before such an enemy. Her cry is the cry of the damned and the doomed. That girl is demon possessed. It was impossible for me to sleep after listening to that program. I walked the floor, crying to God to deliver the poor girl in the city jail. The longer I prayed, the heavier the load became. I said, oh God, if the devil's in that girl, you can cast him out. Please do it. After I prayed at length, God spoke to my heart, if you'll go to jail and pray for her, I'll deliver her. In an unthinking second, I replied, no, God, I can never go to that place. There have been scientists, professors, legal experts, and even spiritualists trying to help that girl, and they all have had adverse publicity in the newspapers. I can't go. Finally, I decided the next morning I would go and pray for the girl. In a city of over 2 million people and in a prison of mammoth proportions of Bilibid, it's not easy to get an interview with such a notorious person. On my way to town the following morning, I stopped at the home of my architect, Leopoldo Coronel. He's a personal friend of Mayor Laxon of Manila. At my request, he called the mayor on the telephone for an interview. The mayor was willing for me to pray for Clarita, but he said he personally never wanted to see her again. His one stipulation was that Dr. Mariano Lara, chief medical advisor of the Manila Police Department, would grant his permission. Mr. Coronel, my architect, did not know Dr. Lara, but another friend, Mr. Domingo Sapida, a building contractor, knew him, and he called him for me and requested an interview. This was granted. We arrived at Bilibid Prison and were escorted to the morgue. The first thing I noticed was a cadaver on the slab. The surroundings were eerie. Another corpse was wrapped in a blanket on a stretcher awaiting attention. On a table were a dozen or more jars of spare parts of human beings and alcohol. We found out later they were for student demonstrations. Sitting on a bench in the long, drab morgue, we heard Dr. Lara, a professor and department head of pathology and legal medicine at the Manila Central University and professorial lecturer of legal medicine, University of Santo Tomas, admit that in his 38 years of medical practice, he had performed over 8,000 autopsies, and that he had never accepted the theory that there is a non-material force existing anywhere in the universe. But this baffling Filipina girl, being bitten by devils, had changed his philosophy of life. He turned to me and said, "Reverend, I'm humble enough to admit that I am a frightened man." I told him I would be glad to come and pray for the girl if he would permit. The doctor said he would welcome me. Then I requested that no medication be given the girl during the time that I'm praying for, and that no other groups be permitted to pray for her or offer assistance in any way. If Jesus healed her, he must have all the glory for the same. Dr. Lara agreed. We set the time of prayer for the following morning at 8:30. I had not eaten since the night before, so I fasted the rest of the day and spent the time alone in prayer and reading the Word of God. The following morning, I arrived at Bilibid Prison. Upon entering its dreary walls, I felt like there was going to be a contest between the God of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Ancient Bilibid, with its centuries of bloody history, was to witness a new kind of battle. Here the Spaniards imprisoned their victims. Here the Japanese conducted uncounted atrocities. Here the American missionaries almost starved until the day of liberation. To say the least, it's an uninviting place to pray the prayer of deliverance. On the first morning, I was accompanied by the architect of our church, Mr. Leopoldo Coronel, a Roman Catholic. With Dr. Lara, I found a professor from the Far Eastern University. When we started walking toward the women's cell block, I saw police officers, newspaper men representing the local and foreign press, photographers, and others. As Dr. Lara and I led the way down the dusty prison road through the barbed wire gates to the sentries on duty, I almost felt as if it was the end of all things. Following behind me was a motley crowd without the slightest idea of what they were going to see. I was the only Protestant in the entire group. By the time we'd assembled in a small chapel for women prisoners, there must have been about 100 spectators, including prisoners. I actually felt that my greatest battle would be with the spectators. However, I found that they were friendly and even sympathetic. Most of them had already seen the teeth bites on the girl. They already saw and observed the failure of the doctors, the psychiatrist, and the spiritualist. But they had never heard prayer for the diseased and demon-possessed. They were of no spiritual assistance to me. The small chapel had steel-barred windows. It had been a very primitive Roman Catholic altar at one end of the room. It had a wooden bunk and a couple of small handmade chairs. Otherwise, it was dreary and barren. After we all gathered in the chapel, Dr. Lara commanded that Clarita be brought in. As the girl entered the door, she observed each person slowly and closely. I suppose she was looking for the doctors who urged her to have the devils bite her again and again. When she came to me at the end of the line, her eyes widened and she glared at me, saying, "I don't like you." These were the first words the devil spoke through her lips to me. They used her lips constantly to curse me, to curse God, to curse the blood of Christ. She did this in English, and yet after she was delivered, I had to converse with her through an interpreter as she could not speak English. After she spoke, I had her sit on a wooden bench, and I drew a chair up in front of her and began saying, "Clarita, I've come to deliver you from the power of these devils in the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Suddenly the girl went into a fit of rage. She screamed, "No, no, they will kill me." Her body became rigid. She became unconscious. This had baffled the doctors when they tried to analyze her case. But I had dealt with devils before and understood some of their antics, so taking hold of her head with both hands, I cried, "Come out of her, you evil and wicked spirit of hell. Come out of her in Jesus' name." She immediately began to rage again. This was the first time she had instantly come back from one of the trances. With tears flowing down her cheeks, she begged me to leave her alone. And she showed me terrible marks on her arms and neck where she'd been bitten that moment. I was shocked. There were the terrible teeth marks, so severe that some of the small blood vessels under the skin were broken. Rather than feeling like quitting, I simply forgot that I was surrounded with unbelievers and went into the greatest battle of my life. I have never known anything like it. The devils would curse God, and I would demand them to quit and tell them God is holy. Then they'd curse the blood of Jesus, and I rebuked them, reminding them that He is the master over every evil power and that His blood is holy. Then they cursed me in the vilest language. They declared they'd never leave. It seemed that the powers of darkness and the power of righteousness were in deadly conflict. I was only the mouthpiece for righteousness. Clarita was the mouthpiece of the devil. No doubt the noise could be heard for some distance in the prison. Finally, now, I'm just trying to get a simple gestalt across. These are Catholic demonologists I'm reading first. This is a Pentecostal. I've worked with Lester Sumrall. I've preached in his church. We conducted seminars together in San Diego. I've known Lester around the world. I've preached in the church in Manila. I've preached with Lester in Hong Kong. I know his work in Brasilia. In his prime, he was probably one of the greatest missionaries ever to go overseas. I got into a taxi in 1963 in the giant city of Manila and said, "I want to go to the Christ is the Answer Church." Every taxi driver knew where it was. This event built that church. Every newspaper in Manila had carried the story of Clarita Villanueva. And the church was born. The tragedy of the story is the girl began to be exploited after her deliverance. That's why I want to stay on this subject of demonology. People prey on the sensational.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.